chapter, and these forms, I'm just sort of getting the conversation going, I'm the controller. Not really, but when we talked about doing these forms at the symposium, we thought instead of just saying, okay, now everybody can come and just ask questions of the presenters and go from there, we thought we'd give it a little context under the theme, turning the church inside out, upside down, in the house, on the street, all around, whatever. And so we came up with two sort of themes that we thought would fit. And tonight's is Who's Afraid of the Theology of the Cross. And Fred gave us a great entree to that this morning, I think, in his Bible study, when he talked about some of the people talking about transforming church who never mentioned the cross, and that there indeed are people out there who are quite afraid of the theology of the cross, and since that belongs to our heritage, we do that. So it's just, we're open for conversation on this topic, and I don't know if the three of you all want to make some kind of a comment to start with, and that'll maybe get the ball rolling a little bit.
I said too many comments. You guys start.
I mean, I certainly haven't prepared anything.
No.
But yes.
Would it help to have an understanding of what your definition is of the theology of the cross? Because there may be different points of view.
Okay, you're out. You guys are out.
Go for it, Al.
I've got my popcorn. I'm okay.
As long as you share it. I think Professor Fred should lead, don't you, Ron? Because he's done so many great sessions on theology of the cross, and then we can sort of pepper in comments after you tell us what it really is.
Well, it's a much misunderstood thing.
Yeah.
And that's because it's hard to understand, and it's easy to misunderstand. And even when you understand it, it's easy to lose it again. And to think you've got it when you don't, partly because it is so counterintuitive, it runs against everything else that works naturally in our brains and in our hearts and minds. When what Luther meant by the theology of the cross, and I'm using my own words here now, I'm not quoting Luther, and I'm not quoting any other systematic theologians or Luther scholars, but as I understand it, it's really a very simple idea with some profound implications. Theology is simply the business of trying to find a way to talk about God. And the theology of the cross says that when you start talking about God, that's the place you look for the primary and the clearest revelation of God. If you want to know what God is about in the world, that's where you look. Which means, among other things, that you don't find God in power and in works of awe and majesty. You find God in weakness. You find God in powerlessness. You find God in suffering. That does not mean that suffering is good. That's one of the major misunderstandings of theology of the cross, that it glorifies suffering. If you understand theology of the cross, it does not do that. But it is true that sooner or later, everyone suffers. And sooner or later, everyone goes through abandonment. And the theology of the cross would say that it's precisely in the moment that one is abandoned and one is in suffering, that if you understand the theology of the cross or have the faith that comes out of that conviction that that's the place that you see God in the crucified Christ, the truth is that in that moment, you're finally with God. Because because that's where God chooses to reveal God's self in the world. At its simplest, that's what theology of the cross is. So you don't go looking for God. I mean, God, you know, obviously we know that the church, the Christian church, in its theologies of revelation, has found God all over the place. God reveals God's self in the creation, which includes us and includes the mountains and includes the sunset and includes all kinds of other wonderful things, including lots of really deadly and dangerous things. God reveals God's self in all kinds of other ways. But Luther's idea is that if you really want to know the most central thing that God reveals, it's in the cross. So I'll let it go at that, at least for starters.
Fred, I have a question from this morning. You said, you talked a lot about, you know, with the Greek or the Hebrew words were that meant for lots of different things, but one was for wilderness. And especially the Old Testament wilderness. Is it the same, and you talked about how wilderness is a place with no words, you know, no way to talk about it was sort of what I got out of that. Maybe I'm off base, but is it the same word for wilderness when Jesus is in the wilderness right after his baptism as in the wilderness from Exodus? Did they use the same word?
Well, it's two different testaments, so it's two different languages.
Okay.
The Greek of the New Testament uses a word in all those texts that the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, uses for wilderness. And so When in the story of the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness, in all the places in, for example, the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus is feeding in the wilderness, in both of those stories, the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000, those are wilderness-related stories. And every time it says in those stories that they were in a lonely place, the word is actually the word for wilderness.
Okay.
The same one that's used back in Matthew 4, Mark 1, and Luke 4 for the temptation in the wilderness, and it's the same word as the word for wilderness in the Greek version of the Old Testament.
Okay.
And, you know, and, well, I don't know.
I guess for me what I was wondering is, did Jesus experience that time, a time in his life for which he had no words? It's like, okay, Jesus is baptized, the heavens are opened up, God says, here's my son, okay, out in the wilderness you go. And it's like, well, now what am I supposed to do? Did he kind of have that experience like the Israelites did when they went into the wilderness? Well, wait, yeah, you got us out of slavery, but now we're doing this thing we don't know how to do. Was Jesus in a place where he felt like, okay, I'm not really sure what I'm doing after, but I'll out. I don't know. In a way, that's sort of comforting to me to know that Jesus wandered around a little bit trying to figure it out before his ministry actually started. Does that make
sense? Well, yeah, I mean, my answer to that would be Jesus is kind of always in the wilderness. Throughout, especially the synoptics. I mean, the Gospel of John has its own way to weave in the temptation of Jesus. Yeah, he's in the wilderness as much as he's out. And it's always for Jesus a time of some kind of testing. And, you know, because that's what the wilderness is about in the Hebrew Bible, the whole period. I mean, the book of Deuteronomy says the whole thing was one long test. God put Israel to the test, and Israel put God to the test. Mm-hmm. And everything was being tested. The people, the relationship between God and people, everything. And, you know, this business that I do with Midvar, you know, the place beyond words, I really mean more than beyond words. I mean, it's the place where nothing makes sense anymore. It's the place where we just don't have categories for dealing with what we're experiencing. many, many years ago, I got divorced and my wife moved out. And for about 2 days, I couldn't find my clothes. I was lost in my own house. I was disoriented. I couldn't keep track of time. I couldn't keep track of my stuff, but I was in the place I had lived for 11 years. That's the wilderness. Right. You're suddenly in a place where everything has shifted and you don't, nothing makes sense anymore. Nothing, I mean, that's wilderness.
Isn't that sort of what the cross is too? I mean, for,
well, I think
that, didn't make any sense.
I think Mark's passion narrative and crucifixion scene is another place of beyond words. Mm-hmm. And the only words he had are words that he learned when he was a little boy that we call Psalm 22. Mm-hmm. Memorized words that came to him, which I consider the Holy Spirit's gift for just that kind of moment. Because what are you supposed to say when somebody does that to you?
It seems to me that even in John, when Jesus, chapter 6 about the bread of life, and then what happens is so many people, his disciples, leave it. I got to wonder what that left Jesus thinking. You know, here I have come for them, even when he's back at his hometown, and they reject it. You know, all those kind of rejections, that's wilderness stuff too for him.
Yeah. I mean, in John too, John also, that Chapter 6 begins in the wilderness. That's the feeding of the 5,000, and they try to make him a king. That's a moment of the temptation, you know, that because they want a bread king, but that's not what he's about. And then all this other stuff happens. People begin to leave him when he talks about what this eating really means. Yeah, absolutely. That whole thing is a wilderness story.
If we can, I'd like to go back for a moment. When you're describing the theology of the cross and trying to flesh it out a bit, you mentioned that it doesn't glorify suffering if you understand it. But I just want to just be a little more clear on what that means. If the crucified God is a God that we look to find where God is in this world, I wonder how responsible of an image that is to propound from the pulpit to say, someone who's suffering from abuse, someone who's suffering from economic oppression, to say, no, this is where we find God, right here. And how are you sure to draw a distinction between, oh, God's with you in the suffering, and you're more of a Christian for accepting the suffering in a saintly manner? How do you draw that line of distinction?
Well, I don't think you're more of a Christian for accepting suffering in a saintly manner, and I would not preach what you just said. I would never do that. That would be an abuse and a misuse of the theology of the cross.
Is it more like God suffers there with you?
Yeah, Jesus once said, if you don't need a physician, I got nothing for you. I came for people who need a physician. I came for people who are broken. If you're broken, I got something for you. If your life is fine, if everything's together and you're on cruise control, great, good for you. But someday, stuff's going to catch up with you. And this isn't Jesus' words, this is me now. Someday, people will turn against you. Someday, your body will turn against you. Someday, you're going to suffer. And someday, you're going to be the one asking, my God, why? And precisely in that moment of our abandonment, God meets us.
So there's nothing redemptive about that suffering?
Hell no.
Absolutely.
Suffering does not make you a better person. Now, it is true that suffering is always a test. So suffering is always a test of everything about us. And there are texts in the New Testament that say suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces hope. You know, and so it is the case, and philosophers of all different kinds have said this for centuries. Like, you know, Nietzsche is the one who first said, "What doesn't kill me makes me strong." That's just kind of a piece of human wisdom that's out there, that's everywhere. That's not Christianity.
When you mentioned the Romans, that Romans passage about endurance and all that stuff, I think really to get Paul's point there, you need to turn that one inside out, or upside down anyway, and read it backwards. Because it says, because of this gift of hope that's been poured into our hearts by the Holy Spirit, then we can get through the suffering with, you know, and we end up having the integrity and the endurance. And that Paul talks, it isn't like this pattern where you go and make sure you can endure so that you'll be this person of integrity, so when you meet suffering, it's all going to be great. No, it starts with the gift of the hope that we have in our calling, you know, as people, and to be in whatever the circumstance, you know, sort of bottom up thing. You know, is that helpful, Michael? Are we getting there for you, Michael? Is this?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I want to take a little different cut at your comment. I guess I don't think Jesus was really saying that those Pharisees were okay. Oh. I think he said, "I didn't come for those who think they're healthy," because he saw through them and knew that they were just as broken as the broken ones, but they didn't face it. They were putting up a facade, which is why he called them so often hypocrites, you know, whitewashed tombs.
Yeah.
That they were just as broken as the local prostitute or tax collector or leper, but they weren't facing it. And Jesus said, just as you said, "I can do you no good as long as you're not willing to own your condition."
Yeah.
But I think the reason he was so confronted with them is he was trying to break through their facade so that they could see what he had to offer them.
Yeah.
Namely healing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just kind of like Jesus' psychological way of doing it by not saying, by not translating it the way, you know, the way you offered the translation. Of course he's being sort of mildly sarcastic, you know, but I'm not about to go around as a representative of the body of Christ and corner people on the street and say, "You don't know it, but you need what I have." You know, but I find that, you know, it's just like what Jesus said, you know, if you're broken, I got something for you.
Mm-hmm. I guess to me, the people that we have to confront that with most are the Pharisees that we are in our congregation. Like, that's where the Pharisees are today, is in our congregations, where we put up so much superficial facade and we're not real.
Yeah.
And I think that those are the ones that Jesus had the toughest time with. And I think if we were to truly be a prophetic church, we'd have to confront ourselves and the people in the pews with that superficiality and saying, you know, there's no gospel for you if you don't see that you need it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not called to be a prophet, so the only person I prophesy to is myself.
Wait, we're speaking to ourselves. Yeah.
Donnie, yeah. And then Keith, and then you.
Just to give it a real-life perspective, I was a child abuse prosecutor for about 10 years, and repeatedly in the course of that, if there were a group of daughters being abused by their father, the oldest daughter would sacrifice herself for her younger sisters and say, "Dad, if you just abuse me, please let my other sisters, don't do this to them." Mm-hmm. That to me is the act of Christ, or the act of God in the midst of suffering. It never worked. He always abused them all. But in that little child who was probably unchurched, probably had no education, she made that ultimate sacrifice for her sisters. it's to me that that is God acting through suffering. Yes.
Are you saying that that suffering was redemptive?
No, I'm just saying that you could find these purely Christ-like motivations in a child who had no knowledge of God or no knowledge of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And yet somewhere in their soul is God who said, I'm going to sacrifice myself for my sisters. Just a purely awesome act from an 8-year-old that just astonished me every time I saw it. And it happened frequently, actually.
It's like that Amish girl in Ohio when that fellow killed all those kids in that school. The oldest girl said, start with me.
Yeah.
Thinking that maybe if he got it out of his system, it could save the rest, you know.
Yeah.
I know there's a cue here, but back on suffering and redemptive stuff, to suffer in that way is demonic. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing redemptive in it.
No.
It's just demonic. Nevertheless, in suffering and in pain, as was said today, how else do we learn compassion? How else do we learn empathy and the ability to walk with? So there is, I believe, not the myth, I mean, I'm not saying the myth of redemptive violence, but there is the wilderness and the suffering for us that can bring for us new insight, new life, redemption, perhaps. I don't know what the words are, but I think out of suffering, when it's not the demonic kind, I think there can be transformation. The theology of the cross calls us.
I think the distinction is important in that story, that the suffering is demonic, but the sacrifice is not demonic. The sacrifice, they're two different words and two different things.
Well, I don't know if suffering is always demonic. I mean, how often have we experienced pain?
No, I'm talking about that particular
suffering. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's a segue into what I was going to ask Dan and Ron to get you guys into the conversation a bit, too. To what degree do we seek it? Dan, you had all those experiences of compassion that came to you. Mm-hmm. Is compassion something that is ever sought? Jesus did say, take up the cross. What does that mean?
I don't know, but that's my part A answer. In all the stories that I told, and I was speaking to a brother after the session today, what I like to highlight about those is I was not seeking any of those moments. You know, there was something outside of me that was going on, and that they were all sort of gifts, you know, in the way that I was transformed in those moments. And so that's why I was trying to be careful to say, you know, this idea of being drained of my virtue was the theme, because I wanted to win the anti-war table fight. I wanted to keep my ministry at that bar. I wanted to write off that pastor who I disagreed about gay and lesbian issues. But in all three of those instances, there were circumstances and practices that had been a part of my life, and other people who called me to account in different ways that touched my heart, that welcomed me into a space of transformation, excitement, a new country of, you know, discipleship and imagination. But in terms of this discussion and the theology of the cross, and I think in some ways it still gets back to Michael's initial challenge, you know, what you just said here, the distinction between is the sacrifice distinct from the suffering. I think when I'm hearing it, it reminds me of a story here at Holden. There was a young man who I met that first year who he was a meth addict in somewhere in Eastern Washington. And Young Life, isn't Young Life the big sort of Jesus freak? Yeah, so anyway, much more conservative theology, obviously. He met some people from Young Life, you know, and they literally saved his life. Literally. You know, took him under their wing and were preaching a very theology of glory. That's the only way I could really think about theology of the cross was always to sort of put it against the sort of Reformed Calvinist concept of the theology of glory. Anyway, that's what they were preaching, and life was saved by these sisters and brothers, but after a while he got so far up in Young Life, they took him to like the compound, like the Young Life compound.
There is.
Yeah, and it totally freaked him out. He realized something was really wrong with this whole thing now. Hmm. And he found through different paths, his way to hold it. And so when I met him here, I knew there was some story that he had, and I asked him to come over and have dinner at our place one night, and he told me his whole story. And I said, well, what do you do with that? I mean, you're here at Holden with a bunch of Lutherans, these mainline Christians who are talking about the theology of the cross, and you had this other thing with Young Life. Where are you at? And he said, you know, Dan, I would never say to any of those sisters or brothers that they were preaching the wrong theology, because at that time in my life, I needed that theology. I needed a theology that would say I could be empowered and I could build the kingdom in my life. And these were people who came to me in my suffering and saved me, literally. He said, but as I moved through it, I realized there was something demonic about it as well. And now I feel more comfortable among the theology of the cross because I'm at a different place in my life. And so, I know I'm being random here too, but when I start to think about the theology of the cross, I worry that just like putting it against the theology of glory, that we can have a tendency as Lutherans to sort of say, well, this is our tribal claim, you know, to theology. We have the theology of the cross, and we don't like that theology of the glory stuff. But I'll tell you, when I turn on the television and watch the Jesus Freak preachers, I see populations of people who are a lot more diverse than any in my churches. People who I know are from a lot different diverse economic classes. Pentecostal Christianity is literally sweeping the two-thirds world on an exponential rate. And that message is not the theology of the cross that is being preached. And they're sending missionaries here to this country from Africa and from Asia. And those sisters and brothers who are the global poor are responding to a message of theology of glory. And their lives are already so filled with suffering. Suffering is just an is. And it's empowering, the message that they're hearing. And I think that's one thing that I'm thinking about as we talk about this theology of the cross thing. I don't want theology of the cross thing to become our little sort of dying moniker that we lay claim to. I think a true theology of the cross would be to lay ourselves bare, to wonder what is going on in the world that the poor are responding so strongly to this message, and we're going to sort of claim our highfalutin theology. There's something wrong with that too. And maybe a true theology of the cross is us giving up our sense of the theology of the cross and asking, what is the Holy Spirit really doing in the world? So anyway, I'll shut up now.
That's interesting. Lee Snook has a book out a few years ago, What in the World is God Doing? And he said, if you ask most Western Christians, nothing. He said, you have to go to Africa to finally hear this other spirit understanding. And Lee Snook is a, you know, he was one of my teachers anyway at Luther. And he's been here. I think, well, what in the world is God doing, you know, in Salishan? You know, can anything good come out of that stupid community? You know, all this suffering and pain and da 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 da. And a lot of people would just say nothing. When I left PLU, one of your brothers, Dick Jungkunst, remember him?
Yeah.
We called them the Lutheran Mafia there, because all the Missouri Synod people that left wound up running PLU for a long time. They're all dead now, by the way, except for Beckermeyer. I think he's still alive. But Jungkunst, I loved Dick Jungkunst, because he was brilliant. And he was honest, and I told him I was going to Salishan. In his mind, and many others at PLU, by the way, they thought I was going to the 5-star resort down in the Oregon coast.
Oh, yeah.
And they congratulating me, literally. And then I said to Dick Jungkunst, who's a friend, and I said, no, I'm going to Portland Avenue. That's just down the street, about 5 miles. And this is what he said, verbatim. Why are you going to that God-forsaken place? He didn't mean it the way we may hear it now, because he wasn't, but he may have been. But the point is, I've always used that image of the two Salishans. One is the first resort, and one is the last. Right away, people always thought they knew. well, of course, the five-star resort, we don't go. I said, well, why wouldn't you? I go there. I went there for my 25th wedding anniversary. I went there and I got served, and it was expensive. And it was some Lutheran that gave us the free gift. Mm-hmm. And they got candy on the thing, you know. You guys should learn something here about doing stuff like that. And you go there for French food and ethnic dining. It was great. But you go there to be served. The other Salishan, the one that I, you know, sometimes talk about for 24 years, is where you serve. And so for me, I like your question, by the way. Very important. Mm-hmm. And I would only say from my understanding, I'm not a, you know, you already heard how I am. I'm all over the world. But I think the cross, understanding it's especially through Paul at this point, when he calls everything that he thought was important to him, skabula, it's a bunch of shit, and you know it. That's what you said.
What? Yeah, that's right.
And so, skabula, and then I do this theology on toilets, and I have to have the word skabula, and I say when skabula hits the fan, and I have a big toilet on a pedestal and lights, and you know, like I say that to you because that's the only way I could interpret what in Salishan they taught me, and they asked me, and I think what the cross says is what a thing is, not what you want it to be. Oh well, we would really like to have a universe, you know, this. Not a, what do we have? Where are we? How are we starting to relate? And if you do it the other way, we always wind up in starting a program of some sort. That we're going to save all these people. We're going to redeem that mess. And not only do I know Young Life, PLU was a Young Life haven. I mean, half the administrators used to give to that. Mm-hmm. And I work with people who I call grown-up Young Lifers, mm-hmm. who all left it. Mm-hmm. Left it completely. Mm-hmm. But never knock it. They always give respect. So that filled the need of that particular young man or young woman in a way that our theology, if we don't live it, calling a thing what it is. I don't know if you even understand what I'm saying, that you're naming something that is, and it's because, therefore, that's reality language. That's Paul, all through his letters, because, God, therefore. Because he hardly ever says, if God would just show up today, then we'll have a great time. Okay.
We had a question a while ago back there. Okay.
So why is the cross hard to sell, hard to reach?
Oh, and that Schuller, that Greg Schuller quote,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah. Because I think it is. I say he's given us the truth there.
Yeah.
It is a hard sell. Mm. You know, in your examples, Dan, yeah, that's right. I think that people around the world, that kind of message, what does it do? It lifts them up and gives them some sort of dignity, I guess, mm-hmm. and hope mm-hmm. of a different, better life. And maybe this is an aberration of the theology of the cross, is that it glorifies suffering, and if you're down, say, well, God's there, so everything's cool. Mm-hmm. But is there a second step? God's there, and the situation, God wants to transform that situation. Can we say that, or are we being untrue to the theology of the cross?
Well, and also, like my example with this young man here, I mean, are we willing as Lutherans to allow the Holy Spirit to work through different theologies? I don't know, but mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, what's great, what I think what is so great about Lutheranism is it talks about paradox. It talks about the truth of, you know, simul justus et peccator. Man, I can ride that all day, you know. I think that's the truth. But like Schuller's saying, it doesn't sell. I mean, I'm not saying I want things to sell. But I know there's different times in my life when I need a different messages, and they're all in there. There is a theology of glory in this Bible, you know. In the beginning of Mark's gospel, you have Jesus Christ, right? But then right after that, you have Son of God in the first verse, which could be, I don't know, Professor, you know more than me, but I remember sitting through a lecture where in some ways those two words could bring up different image sets for people. Sort of like in Revelation, you have the victorious Lamb. You know, what's going on there? You know, you have these sort of things playing off each other in a dynamic way.
Could I ask, I don't know if you could preach the gospel without preaching the cross. And I think of a cartoon from Bloom County years ago of the first frame is this guy standing in the middle of a dandelion patch. And then the next frame is a wind blowing up through the dandelion patch. And then the next frame is he looks down and all the dandelions have lost their heads. You know? And then the last frame is him having neatly taken off all his clothes and folded them and standing there naked with the dandelions. Yeah. And you don't even need the caption, but it says solidarity at the top. Huh. And that's the conclusion. And to me, that's theology of the cross in a way. And I wonder, even in Africa, as you talk about the effectiveness, I wonder if it's more that than theology of glory, of people willing... I think suffering people identify more with people who are willing to suffer with them and to be present in their suffering than they are worried about doctrinally what you label the theology that's there. But I wonder if you agree with me that you can't preach the gospel without preaching the cross.
Sure, I totally agree.
Any of you?
I totally agree with that as a Lutheran minister. I mean,
I don't care about the Lutheran thing.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't think that's distinctly Lutheran myself. Yeah.
Can you not preach the gospel without preaching the cross? If you're not a Lutheran.
Or because Gordon has all kinds of wonderful gospel without the cross.
Well, what he's got is a program of human transformation
to try to save
the earth and promote human thriving. You know, and that everybody in the world, that's what people do. That's what human beings are about. Everyone's trying to thrive, and, you know, I don't know that everybody's trying to save the planet, because there are some people who are saving their, who are finding their thriving without saving the planet. But, you know, all of that stuff doesn't really have anything to do with Christianity. That's just what human beings do. Human beings have programs of transformation that lead to human thriving. You know, and we have it wired that somehow God approves of these programs, and that God's job is to make sure that we thrive properly. And, you know, that's just nothing but Joel Osteen. God wants us to be rich. God wants us to be powerful. God wants us to be on top. You know, and I'm sorry, but that's not Christianity. That's just what everybody does.
Yes.
I guess part of it, you know, the thing that I think is significant of what Christ says about the cross is he first said, deny yourself. And I think it's, we live in this self-help, everything is self. Even Schuller, who likes, you know, to deal with the issues that we have around our self-worth and self-esteem. But the fact is that the cross is about denying oneself. And that suffering comes as you deny yourself for someone else. And I guess I was thrown off by the point of suffering, redemptive or good or bad. A woman who was abused, who... does her testimony that she, you know, would not wish that on anybody. But through that abuse, she came to know the Lord and his suffering and his cross. And so, you know, like Joseph, what was meant for evil, God meant for good. And so in that sense, it was for her redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And she takes on helping others who have been in that same situation because she knows what it was. So, I mean, I don't know where that comes together. I don't want that or choose that. I mean, my children born with incurable disease, as my son would always say in his preaching, when people say to him that this is the cross he has to bear, he says, no, this is the cross my dad and mother bear. Mm. But, you know, a fatal disease, that's still something that we would not have chosen, but it certainly is something that's brought us closer to know what God's love and power is all about. So.
One of the, Ron was talking to tonight about some of the saints from here who are no longer with us and other places. And one person was Pastor Carol Nolte, who was out there for many years, and she used to teach card weaving and inkle weaving and stuff like that. In fact, she did it in the bottom of Chile 7 and way back before the craft. And one time Carol, this was like 25 years ago or something, she was walking across the grass in the summer and she stepped in a hole and broke her ankle. It was really annoying. She had to go to Chile and get a cast, come back, and then so we got her all set up in Chalet 7 with her foot up, and she can still teach her inkle weaving, card weaving, and do all this stuff too. And this one woman came into the class and she looked at Carol's cast and said, "Oh, that's going to be such a blessing for you."
Oh,
you know, that theology that says somehow if you're suffering, there's going to be a moment here where God's going to get it. And all Carol, I mean, Carol, when she was talking about later, she said she wished like crazy that she'd broken her arm so she could have whacked it. And Carol's response was just, there is no blessing in this. And I think that you know, that's just a short form of, you know, that God may be present in our suffering and stuff, but the suffering itself is no blessing and no gift,
right?
And has no grace of itself at all. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like the difference in the different Christian camps. Romans 8:28, one translation says, all things work together for good. Like as if there's a balance, and no matter what horrific things happen to you, it's going to balance out. Mm-hmm. As compared to, in all things, God works for good. I mean, there's a huge difference there in worldview.
I left here in 66, I think. Carol and Mary, whoever you all were, wanted me to go back to college. I already failed 5 years, so took another 5. And I remember that because I went home to Brooklyn and I got a call from Carol. This building, by the way, a lot of it had to do, I asked, this is the first place I worked, it was in the attic, by the way, with crazy Walt Olson, who was an alcoholic, and put the electricity in. So you're lucky the thing even works. So, these poles were stripped outside over a long time by a woman called Eleanor Orlow. And her husband, Max, and they had 3 beautiful daughters, young, and lived on Mercer Island. And that's where I met Nancy, who lived on Mercer Island, and da 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 da. Carol called me when I finally got home and actually got to college and said, Max Orlow is dead. These were friends, I mean, this was really, and he said, and there's nothing good I can say about this. And Max had left, and he felt free. They were a Christian Scientist. I don't know what their background was. But they for the first time, they saw the freedom of Christ. And he went to Mercer Island, rented a motorcycle, and couldn't negotiate the term, and was killed. I only say that in light of how there was no anything good to say about this. There was no blessing to the kids. There was no blessing to Eleanor. And I was in tears, and I came back again just to see, to be part of that particular suffering. Mm-hmm. I would only encourage us that a lot of what I hear about the suffering is communal. And what, if we don't understand it communally, I mean, you don't all have to be suffering the same dealy out here. But we know, and that's how I used Kretzmann, who taught me right here, this understanding of a new way to see community. And in the little book they have, they write, McKnight and him, authentic community can only be experienced through suffering, death, and tragedy. And that only then can you celebrate these incredible parties and the fun. And I believed around this whole thing, that's kind of how I started to at least learn it. Not from seminary, but from people who understood and were trying to figure out how do you build community. And I think this place is an incredible picture. If I could cut out all of Holden Village and call it my urban experience, you could. And you could, even the orientation kind of gets at it. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of, you start to see, oh my God, that's what's going on in the midst of this. Lastly, the man who did influence me, Carol Henderly, would almost drive people nuts with the microphone because he often referred back to World War II, being in a prison camp without the food, and in that experience, then he was able to start to translate what life in the faith really is about. And I say that because I've often heard in the community I work in, when you bring up things like your son is dead, I mean, I've watched people just break down 15 years after the event. I mean, just break down. As if somehow this all goes away, the suffering, death, and tragedy. Oh, now I'm going on and on. The other thing, though, I do work with is Buddhists. And, you know, Buddhism is an interesting religion. Because suffering is the given.
Yes.
Okay. And then they even tell you how to get out of it. But, so in this matrix set on the east side of Tacoma, 6 Buddhist temples, it's a riot. And by the way, Santa Claus, this is my last little random thought. You know, what's your name? No, right in behind you.
Dave Grohl.
I mean, isn't that Santa? So, I play Santa, by the way. I hate Santa. I've never liked Santa. The theology of Santa. Yeah, I know. He goes the full route. And I might do it in my retirement because I need the money. But I've always done it free in the community. So here I am with this international group trying to learn English as a second language, sitting here in my Santa outfit. And I have a very nice Santa outfit, by the way, and very expensive. And they always come and take pictures. So who do I have sitting on my lap? A Buddhist monk. I mean, you have to laugh. That there's some things that just really are funny in community and religion, of course.
So what did the Buddhist ask for?
Well, he couldn't speak English. I don't know what he asked for. He never got it, I'm sure.
It reminds me of what Fred, you said today about, you know, wilderness being a sort of a given too, you know, that we're all always in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And that's what I learned from this class I took on Buddhism when I was in seminary. It finally, something clicked in me that, you know, part of my Western, whatever, lens was that, you know, suffering was this other, like it was this thing to be avoided or this thing to talk about in a certain way. But when I took this class on Buddhism, this idea that you would always be, that suffering was a given, and that maybe it was less the question of suffering good, suffering bad, suffering redemptive, suffering this, that if you could accept that you were always in the wilderness, or that suffering was a given as a part of our human existence, then I could go to questions of redemption, Michael. Because if suffering is a given, then maybe it's more about framing suffering in certain ways, instead of suffering just being an automatic, demonic, or evil thing. Do you know what I'm getting at here? Like, one of the things that I remember reading when I first read Gandhi that blew my mind was one time Gandhi was talking about nonviolence, and he said, we don't practice nonviolence as a tactic, first of all. We're not doing this so we can win. anything. We practice nonviolence so that we give our enemy the opportunity to save their own soul. Mm. To save their own soul by not being violent to us. And I remember reading that being like, what the hell is that? Now, is that demonic in the sense that Gandhi was, I mean, I think the man was a little crazy too. But anyway, I mean, was it demonic in the sense of the way Martin Luther King would talk about redemptive suffering in the sense, I mean, someone said it, you said it here, the distinction that the suffering isn't blessed, but if the sacrifice is chosen by that person to achieve something like justice or something like a transformation in the heart of your enemy, is that demonic? I mean, your question, Michael, which was the first question, I think still is floating around in this room.
Here and then waiting.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I think that precisely, though, comes back to the question of the Pharisees. The fact of the matter is that the Pharisees had a very neat way of thinking, that if you're suffering, you must be doing something wrong. And therefore, we see him as one despised, smitten by God. Yet, as Isaiah says, because our concept of suffering is, you know, you did something wrong.
Yeah.
And the fact is that as one chooses to do something right, one does not do oneself a favor as much as Dr. King and Gandhi said. One really wants to set free the person from what it is that holds them bound. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens through suffering, which is what the cross is about. Mm-hmm. That Jesus accepting this suffering sets us free from what binds us, which is precisely what the Pharisees could not see, that they were so bound up in their own self-righteousness that they didn't understand that the righteousness they were righteousness.
Wayne.
When I think about the theology of the cross, I always think about, I have two observations about that. And one is that when we talk about the theology of the cross, it's a theological construct that I cannot grasp and hold on to. It's like almost a moving target. I think I've got it, but then I don't have it, if you know what I mean. The Apostles' Creed I can hang on to. You know, that's a theological construct. I'm okay with that. You know, it's the same thing. I say it over and over again. But theology of the cross, especially when we start talking about suffering, is part of it, but it's not the major part of it, from my observation. And what I have found helpful over the years when I think about theology of the cross is that very classical Lutheran confessional question. So why did Jesus have to die? And it's in the answer to that question, which isn't always the same, I think. So why did Jesus have to die? You cannot escape the cross without, you know, as you answer that question. So why did Jesus have to die? When Lutherans talk about theology of the cross, I think it's wrapped up in that question. So why did Jesus have to die? So whether you preach a sermon or, you know, teach a faith formation class or tell a children's story, you have to ask yourself this question. So why did Jesus have to die? And the answer, I think, to that question really brings you to the cross, brings you to what is.
Will you answer? Will you quick answer it though?
What's that?
What's your answer?
Why did Jesus have to die?
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Okay. I think it has to do with the fact that we have to understand who we are. And let me put it this way: a cross without a cruciform on it, without a body on it, doesn't tell us anything. But you put that body on it, and you see the frailty, the vulnerability, our own human sinfulness. You see. Fred said it, there isn't any kinds of transformation programs that are going to work for humans like the cross of Jesus Christ. What it is that God has done for us in what Christ has done on the cross. A lot of people get a little nervous then about atonement theology. But what we're talking about is the fact that God comes, you know, to be doing for us what it is that we can't do for ourselves. Because obviously, if there was some other way that we could be saved, some other way that the world could be transformed, then obviously Jesus wouldn't have had to die. You know, we could have done it some other way. And so, I think what happens is we get the kind of Marcus Born pep talks We get a lot of stuff in which we think we can do it ourselves, but we can't save ourselves. And the only way in which we see that God can do it for us is the Christ on the cross. So why did Jesus have to die? So that God, so that we could see what God has done for us. And that is grace.
I like that, but one thing it brings to mind, you use the word program, you know, and that's... But I don't think that the cross has had necessarily great results either. If the point is to deal with the problem
theology of glory,
human suffering. Wait, hold on a second. Here's what I'm saying. I still hear in your argument about why Jesus had to die some kind of end. If we can't get it by a program Jesus gives us, or we can't get it by a program Marcus Borg gives us, or theology of glory gives us, there's still something going on there when we say, well, since it couldn't come through the human program, or it couldn't come through walking and talking with Jesus, it had to be this other thing, this transformative thing. We're still searching for a solution to the problem of evil and suffering. And what I'm wondering there is, if I say that to my kids, if my kids ask the question you just asked, why did Jesus have to, well, Jesus had to die so that we wouldn't have to worry about this program, because we always get wrapped up in the program and it ends up becoming this totalitarian nightmare, or we just can't figure it out anyway. But we need that transformative thing to realize we can't do it. Well, my question would still be, well, how's that worked out for us? I mean, we're still also hungry for that solution. And I'm not saying like theology of the cross is wrong because of this. I'm just saying that if we ignore that people are still yearning for those answers, and that we're all yearning for those answers, for the problems of suffering and human evil and all that stuff, then we're missing something there too. I mean, to just rest there on what you said, I mean, I think that's why we're not relevant in some ways, talking about the theology of the cross, or why we're not having as much of an effect on American Christianity or global Christianity.
And my response to that is, we're looking for results.
Yeah.
We're looking for some way that we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be able to do it. But when we see what it is that God has done for us on the cross, in the dying of Jesus Christ and the rising, we can't do it. We cannot save
I totally ourselves. Agree with you. I'm still saying there's still a so what after that. There is still a reality of a so what after that. So what? Okay, we can't do it. So what are we supposed to do? We still got to live. We still have to find ways. People are still going to fight for justice. People are still going to yearn for food. People are still going to make their way through the world. I'm trying to make what you're saying relevant, brother. Okay? Now, maybe that's my problem of trying to look for results, but there it is. I mean, that's a reality of being human.
And that's a wonderful segue into tomorrow night's forum. So, yeah. So please join us tomorrow night at 9:00, and we'll continue the conversation. Thank you all very much.
What's tomorrow?